same page, jolly good.
Right.
The vidcast I've put up this morning summarises a lot of this stuff as well.
Bless you. The first thing is trying to figure out where all this finance law comes from. Okay. The finance law we're going to study is the law that relates to the entire UK, is the jurisdiction, because the ultimate root of a lot of this finance law comes from EC directives. Okay. So that's where it starts, at the European Union level for most of it. And because the UK is the member state, the UK becomes the jurisdiction for finance law. Okay. However, within that, we're also going to study English private law again. So contract law, tort, fiduciary principles, property principles, criminal law, and so forth. Okay? So those are the sources of what we're looking at. A combination of financial directives and then their implementation into the UK by the Financial Services Authority, which is the UK financial regulator. And we're going to spend a lot of time looking at what that regulator does, what its objectives are in the statutes, and how it's supposed to function. Okay? So it's stuff you studied last year with Kenneth Armstrong and Nick Bernard, most of you. It's those kind of basic EU law ideas implemented into UK. The UK statute that does most of this is the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000, which has been amended a number of times. You'll come to know that act well as we go through the course. Financial Services and Markets Act 2000, or FSMA, as everyone refers to it, because Financial Services and Markets Act is just too long. Where? We're all too young and good-looking to cope with all those words. FSMA, that's what we're going to refer to it as, or FSMA occasionally. Okay. We're then also going to look at the marriage between the regulations that the FSA creates in what is known as the FSA handbook, which makes it sound much more casual than the regulatory rulebook it actually is. It's huge. There are so many regulations. We're going to focus on particular bits. The marriage between the FSA handbook and substantive law, all the law you've already been studying. Here's how I think we need to think about how English law fits together. I use the analogy of a castle in the textbook. Okay, I like castles. The way castles look at from above, the way castles operate looked at from above is generally that you have a central castle keep, and then you have an outer wall. Okay. And actually, when Richard Nobles gets into his stride and starts explaining systems theory to you, this is a lot of the metaphor, not castles, but kind of cells, that gets used up by a lot of the theorists. If you remember the Two Towers, or all those Lord of the Rings films, yes, it all goes horribly wrong at Helm's Deep. They defend the outer wall, yes, defend this outer wall with its various towers, and then as the baddies, what were they, orcs or whatever they were called, they all then retreated back to the central keep. Okay, yeah, let's get our geek on, yeah, Lord of the Rings. So they retreat to the central keep, and this was the basic theory of castles. In big medieval castles, you would actually have basically marketplaces within the castle wall, which then grew to be kind of cities or towns or whatever. And so there's actually a lot of people would live and trade stuff inside the wall, and then when things went wrong, you all rush back into the central keep. I think the way to think about how law functions is to think about it as being a combination of concepts in the centre and then contexts around the outside. This is my suggestion. This is my methodology for this, and I talk about this in the textbook at length. The concepts are basically all the compulsory subjects you've had to study thus far. And the reason why you have to study them, the reason they're compulsory, is because you need them for a qualified law degree. Why are they the subjects that are picked? Because it's thought, you know, the consensus is, those are the key things you need to know to go out in the world and be a practicing lawyer. You need to know about criminal law. You need to know about contract. You need to know about property. Nowadays, you need to know about the European Union as well as public law more generally. These are all the central concepts. Okay? And fiduciary law and equity are all part of that, as well as property. It seems to me that all other areas of law, particularly these optional subjects you go on to study, whether it's family law, that word says family, whether it's company law, whether it's labour law, I'm just picking examples as they occur to me, whether it's finance law, What these areas generally do is they draw from this well of central concepts. If you're studying company laws, all this side of the room seems to be yesterday, no one over here. What company law does, as you see this going through, is it builds on the old law of associations. If anyone tells you it's an odd kind of a contract at the heart of a company, it's not. It's unincorporated associations. Everything we did in Property 2. Remember all that stuff, unincorporated associations? That's what companies used to be. Before the Salomon decision in 1897 that said that companies are separate legal persons, they were just associations, built on trusts law and partnership law. A combination of two central concepts, contract law and trusts law. Mesh them together, you develop the company. So it develops as its own separate context by drawing on those central principles. And then you add on to that the Companies Act 2006 and all the regulations and statutory instruments that come with that, and you develop another area of law. Family law borrows from lots of ideas about property, you know, who owns the home, what rights you have to the home, and then creates the Matrimonial Causes Act, all the divorce and child law, and develops again another field. But you're drawing from central concepts, the ones you need, and then applying them in a new context. Finance law is doing the same thing. We're going to borrow contract law, we're going to borrow tort law, we're going to borrow property, equity, fiduciary law, criminal law concepts, all out of this central well, mash them together with the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000 and this FSA handbook, and we create a brand new context out on the castle wall, basically. When Richard Nobles talks about systems theory, the way the old systems theorists used to talk about this was like biology and cells. It's about how do we interact between the central concepts and the context? How do those ideas, I mentioned Caparo and Dickman yesterday, how does that law that you know very well from studying it last year, how does that apply in the financial context? What is it about the particular regulations we're going to study when we look at prospectuses and securities and all these things in a few weeks' time? How does that change the central concept? But we're borrowing those basic legal ideas. So that's our methodology. These are our sources. We're drawing from the central well of concepts and applying them in a particular context. That explains labour law, that explains probably most of the optional subjects you've picked, if they're anything to do with private law. I mean, human rights, which we also, you know, draw on similar concepts, particularly public law and conventions and so on and so forth. So it's one way of understanding how the whole of law fits together. Okay? So that's what we're doing. We're going to use a lot of things that are very familiar, but we're going to spend the first few weeks looking at the contextual stuff that's a bit different, and then we're going to marry the two together. So one of the kind of overarching essay themes for the year, really, is thinking, how does that work? How well does that work? How do these two things interact? I think you'll find a parallel there in what Richard will be lecturing you in jurisprudence, I guess, because it's his thing. He loves that. How do these systems interact? Page 10. What is finance law all about? Beginnings. Well, I think it's about that. It's about taking those concepts and applying them to a context. The second bullet point, the bullet points on the handout are me trying to anticipate over the summer what I'm likely to say. So instead of me to keep throwing up PowerPoint slides and reading them off to you, you can hopefully follow my diatribe from there. As I say, I'm taping all these, hopefully. Yes. So you'll be able to, you know, focus in on anything you want later on. Oh, there's someone leaving. Finance law doesn't exist, rather we're creating finance law. I mean that in two different ways. Finance law is, if it's going to become a field, a brand new field. So we're doing it for the first time in that sense. It's very new in the sense that a lot of the financial products we're going to talk about are themselves new. Bless you. Modern ideas. Very modern ideas. Yeah? The development of computers, frankly, have made a lot of this possible in ways that we're going to talk about. It's only because of the computing power people have now that we can start to manufacture these products, that we can start to measure all these risks, we can start to play the markets than we do now. A lot of markets now operate automatically on the basis of computer models which anticipate where the market price has gone and automatically buy and sell. It's one of the things that worries regulators, that it's not even a human brain involved anymore in deciding let's sell or let's buy, it's a computer model doing it automatically. Prices hit 100, that's the price we said, sell everything. And this is what worries a lot of people, that a lot of these crashes arise because the computers are automatically doing things. You just need to kick the plug out of the wall and we could have saved the system, if you like. We talk a lot about modelling and how all that works. So in that sense, we are creating a new field because it's all new. These EC directives are all very new.
ways I'm going to explain in a little while.
It doesn't exist in another sense. Finance law doesn't exist naturally in the world. If you study environmental law, you'll talk about trees, you'll talk about rivers, things that actually exist in the world. Finance law doesn't. It's the product of human brains. All of this stuff is made up. Quite literally, it's made up. It's the product of human minds. We aren't even going to talk about coins. We aren't even going to talk about money that exists. Yeah?
Yeah, salary.
We're going to talk about abstracts, what are referred to as financial products. I love that word, products. Bankers always talk about products, yes? Which makes it sound like cars or biscuits or food or something that matters, yeah? But it's something that is manufactured in a very real sense. It's made up. But they love this idea of products. I think it makes them feel like they're doing something wholesome and natural. Bankers always talk about products. It always was a metaphorical usage that I found really quite bizarre at some levels. Because all this stuff is built on maths and predictions and guesses and gambles and everything else. Law also, if you think about it, is made up. The law on murder, while we all assume every society should have a law against murder, it doesn't exist naturally, it doesn't grow. We don't harvest contract law, yet we've made it up. This is how we've choose to organise our society. In studying a law degree, you are actually being inducted into an ideology. Yes? If you were studying medicine, you'd be studying something real. Yeah? Livers, hearts, you know, legs, things that actually exist. You'd be trying to make them better, or cut them off, or whatever. But law is all made up. So actually what we're studying here are the combination of two made up things, two sets of ideas, two ideologies. And one of the central roles of a financier, it seems to me, is to act as a kind of translator or matchmaker or go-between between two very different sets of ideas. The made up ideas of law and its own language, its own norms, you're becoming quite skilled at and quite used to. So we enter our final years. Soon they'll let you do this for real. How exciting. And on the other hand, you've got all of these financial ideas. All the things the bankers produce. All the things the traders produce. All these people we're going to talk about. And so creating finance law is about understanding how those two different systems interact. This is where you're going to get back to what Richard Noble's going to talk to about jurisprudence, because he loves exactly that. How do systems interact? How do they communicate with one another? So when we looked at West Deutsche Landesbank and Islington, for example, in Law of Property 2 last year, I guess they're going to be doing it this year, that's a clash. That's exactly this kind of clash. I wrote a piece in a collection that Burke's edited a few years ago called, the book is called Lessons of the Swap Cases, and I wanted to call my chapter The Systemic Irritation Between Law and Finance. And Peter, without telling me, changed the title of my chapter to Law of Finance. But what I was interested in was the fact that the bankers thought they were entitled to one thing. We expect to be paid compound interest. And the lawyers said, no, you don't get compound interest for that. You have no property rights, therefore you get no compound interest. And so that was the disappointment. The bankers were horrified that they got £1 million less back from the local authorities than they expected. And that was an example, I think, of this systemic irritation. But that's what we bankers expect. That's how we treat one another. Property law is saying, no. If you had asked us, we would have told you no. What's the matter? So one of the odd things about the finance law community there was they just assumed that what they were doing was legally enforceable, and that's why the 200 writs that flew in relation to all those local authority swaps cases were so upsetting to banking lawyers, because they just expected. They had become their own little community with their own little norms, separated off, they thought, from the whole of the rest of law. And then they met up with the law of restitution and it all got a bit too real. So a lot of what we're studying is how one system of ideas and another system of ideas interact. And so that's what's going on now with all the debates about financial regulation now, right now. It's a banking system which has always said, don't regulate us. Yeah? Clinton in 1999 removing the old Glass-Steagall Act, I'll talk about in a little while, which it required a separation within banks that bankers didn't like. They wanted to be able to sell anything to anybody, and regulation in the US had stopped them. All of the talk now about, oh, don't make regulation too fierce now, we're terribly sorry, versus, you know, kill them, you know, hang a banker, all those T-shirts that have been around, you know, last summer, eat the rich, all that kind of stuff. you know, we've got exactly that kind of clash of ideas now, you know, and where do we draw those boundaries? So that's really what we're studying in its essence.
It doesn't exist, we're making it up.
Good finance lawyers know a lot of law. This is one of those fields that draws across a lot of concepts. You need to know a lot of contract law and tort law and property law and everything else. For example, if you were a family law specialist, you could spend your time advising clients out there in the world and only need to know about the Matrimonial Causes Act, the Family Act, the Children Act. A very valid area of law to practice in, don't get me wrong. But it becomes quite a contained context. Finance law ranges. Tax law ranges. If you want to avoid taxes in many instances, you need to understand, if you want to avoid a property tax, how the law on leases works, for example. How do you structure your lease so it's taxable or not taxable? Finance law is the same. To be a good finance law, you need to understand a huge range of law. And so what I'm trying to do in this course is to help us to understand, you know, what the perimeters and parameters of all that are. Lawyers are risk managers. This is an idea that I kicked about with you yesterday. We'll talk about risk a little more a bit further on. He says as he's trying to cut through a bit of time. So the sources of the law of finance, towards the bottom of page 10. Just in outline at this stage, because we're going to do this in huge detail as we go through the next few topics. We begin with EU law. Now there are areas of finance law that don't start in the European Union. I mean, everything that starts from English private law, contract and so on and so forth, doesn't have a European dimension. But I think the way of understanding how this field fits together is to start with Europe. Okay. Cheers, you see, start with Europe, cheer. The best example and explanation of why European law is the way it is in this context is something called the Investment Services Directive 1993, which has since been repealed. We mention it because it illustrates the way the world used to be. The Investment Services Directive was supposed to cover key financial services, everything except ordinary banking, ordinary deposits. That was the idea. 1993 it was passed. It had taken years to trundle through, as legislation tends to, all those European Union organs. And you talked with Kenneth and with Nick about how Europe has changed, how the committee structures have changed with the role of the Parliament, how legislation is produced and moved through. The Investment Services Directive took a long time. As we'll talk about in later lectures, there has been a long, ongoing European hope to create a single market for financial services that really just hadn't kicked off. In no small part because London wanted to keep itself separate. London wanted to be a third part of a triangle with New York and Tokyo. Yeah? Why should we become part of Europe? We do financial services much more popularly here. Let's stay separate. That'd be the idea. Derivatives really started to happen in the early 1990s, but really took off in the mid-1990s. So this legislation had been going through the European Union, late 80s, early 90s, and then the whole world changed when derivatives came along. Derivatives meant for the first time you didn't need to own shares, you didn't need to own bonds. You could speculate on markets without actually participating in them, using clever mathematical models that we will discuss in future classes. So it was realised that you could pass legislation in this way and it'd be out of date almost immediately because financial markets move so fast and innovate all the time. People go into work in the morning and they're looking to sell something new in a new way. So what we do instead is something called the Lamfalussy process, which we're going to talk about in more detail in later lectures. This was a committee chaired by the Baron Lamfalussy. I can only see an enormous twirling moustache on someone called Baron Lamfalussy. Yeah. He's actually a Belgian central banker. And he chaired a committee of wise men. That's what they're called, the committee of wise men. Yes. They're the ones that went to Jesus on the Christmas day, we don't know. So the committee of wise men. And they looked at the way the European Union was generating its legislation and decided we need to do this more quickly, we need to be more efficient. So what happens now is the directive set out the high-level principles, quote-unquote. High-level principles, sometimes called the framework principles. The general policies and the directives. So the statements tend to be more aspirational. And then there are very detailed technical regulations produced by the Commission. Again, we'll cover all this ground in a lot more detail later lectures. Give you the idea. So the Commission does the nitty-gritty, the detailed work. All of those nitty-gritty regulations are implemented by the FSA in the FSA handbook. But the key focus is going to be on these high-level principles for us at the start, the things that the European Union is trying to achieve. So that's the principal source of a lot of our finance law. So we need to keep an eye on the things that the European Union is trundling through, the things that go through that European digestive process, if you like. Okay. And so this creates a lot of the financial services directives, commission technical regulations as on the handout. Jolly good. All that stuff is then implemented in the UK. The principal implementing statutes I've mentioned, Financial Services and Markets Act 2000. Companies Act 2006 has a lot of stuff in recently, in particular parts, particularly Part 43, which we'll talk about as we go through. And then there's the Banking Act 2009, which got the Royal Assent in February of this year. And I'll put a big block of text about that on the website to update what's in the textbook. So those are some of the principal statutes we'll look at. And then the FSA handbook at the bottom of the page. The FSA handbook you find through looking at the FSA website, fsa.gov.uk, that's where you find that. Very difficult to get that in hard copy. I keep trying to order a hard copy thing and it never comes. And so then under 2.4, the things we're going to look at, contract law, tort law, property law, equity and trust, criminal law, those basic concepts, we're going to think about how they apply in the context. Good idea. Methodology, in a nutshell. The kind of helicopter view of how financial regulation functions. What are some of the key messages before we look at any of its nitty-gritty, which we'll start into today. We're going to do in real detail next week. Primarily, financial regulation, it seems to me, is regulating information. It's primarily concerned with ensuring that financial services providers, what I'm going to call financial institutions, by which I mean banks and everybody, anyone that sells financial stuff, you have to provide suitable information. I think the word suitable deliberately because suitability is a concept we're going to meet a lot when we look at the regulations. Are you selling suitable products to suitable clients in a suitable way, in effect? So it's really all about making sure that all the information is provided. What financial regulation does not seek to do, by and large, is to protect you from your own stupidity. I think there is a perception out there in the world amongst some investors that if it says regulated by the FSA on the bottom, it must be all right. Some kind of kite mark, you know? This thing is safe. This will cause me no harm. The FSA is there. It'll all be fine. Not at all. The regulation is primarily concerned to make sure that you can make informed decisions. If you're stupid or unlucky or whatever it may be, and you lose your money, that's not what the regulation is trying to protect you from. You get the information, you make your own stupid choices. I think that's important to take on at the beginning. And we're going to look at something in particular called conduct of business regulation, which is very big on how we go about that process. Okay, that's going to be, that's topic three. You get a whole seminar on that. And it's bound to come up in the exam. So no protection from your own stupidity, second bullet point. There's a division in conduct of business regulation between expert and inexpert investors. So to the extent we do have something called investor protection, it requires financial institutions to divide between or to classify, as a better word, their customers. Divide between different categories of customer so that you treat those customers appropriately. If you are dealing with another enormous investment bank, then clearly you don't have to explain all the risks to someone else who's a professional. You can probably expect that they understand what they're doing, and you're entitled to treat them entirely at arm's length. If you go to the other end, however, and you're dealing with an ordinary member of the public, then clearly you have to think more about what kind of risks do I need to explain to this person? Are there some kinds of financial products which they simply won't understand and which they shouldn't be allowed to buy in the first place? So that, at root, is what some of that investor protection regulation is doing. So we're going to spend some time on that. Absolutely key. And we'll look at some cases where individuals have decided, no, I know what I'm doing, you know, you can treat me as an expert, you know, I've got lots of money, I've been doing this for years, you know, and what the ramifications are of that. Pretty much, even the case laws have to take the view, if you decide you want to be treated as an expert, then good luck to you. And if you lose all your money, tough luck to you. You know? So this is not about cuddling you and wrapping up in a blanket and looking after you. Okay, it's a cold and terrible world out there, even though it's quite sunny. You know, we're not trying to protect you from loss, we're just informed consent. I think that's, you know, we're trying to give you information and you buy things on that basis.
I think that's a very high-level helicopter principle of that. In terms of banking specifically,
by which I mean the big deposit-taking banks, the ones that, you know, receive your salary electronically and pay it out to you, the ones that are providing you with your overdraft and funding you through university, that kind of banking as opposed to speculative investment. There is another element involved there with banking regulation, which is about looking to the economy more generally. And of course, this has become absolutely key in the last 18 months. So instead of just looking at, you know, protecting investors wherever else it may be, we're also looking at the financial system generally. So that's a theme in regulation there. I'll just rub off my castle.
We should probably make a distinction in our minds
between banking on the one hand and, let's just call it, investment on the other. There was a piece of legislation in the USA, as I say, called the Glass-Steagall Act. When senators generate the legislation in the US, the act tends to get named after them. Glass-Steagall required, after the 1929 Great Crash in New York, which is another fun documentary I'd like to show you sometime, two senators came up with a piece of legislation that said banks should either be involved in ordinary banking, by which you mean taking ordinary customers' deposits, running ordinary bank accounts for ordinary people, making loans, checkbooks these days, you know, debit cards and that kind of stuff as well, standing orders, direct debits, all that kind of basic stuff. And separate, different institutions should do investment things, speculating on share markets, speculating on bond markets, derivatives, all that kind of whizzy investment stuff. And so that division was kept quite jealously. And some, well, bankers often didn't like that, because you had to divide between the big so-called investment banks, as they were always known historically, and the term merchant banks used to be used in London, for reasons I'll explain later on. They were doing all that kind of speculative stuff, providing maybe speculative services for big financial institutions. And then you had the ordinary banks, sometimes called commercial banks, sometimes called retail banks, that were doing the basic deposit-taking stuff. Now, through the 1990s, the pressure grew that banks should be allowed to do both things. The Glass-Steagall Act is a US bit of legislation, but it set a model for around the world, really. It was the Clinton administration that finally bowed to this pressure. And the irony, actually, is, of course, it's a Democratic administration as opposed to a Republican administration. Sorry, a Democrat administration that bows to this pressure, whereas you would have thought the Republicans would have been the ones to help banking out in that way. Just as you might have thought it would be the Conservative Party, not the Labour Party in the UK. But actually it's the Blair administration from 97 and onwards that starts to introduce quite liberal models of financial regulation as well. I think partly because for them it looks like a positive thing for them to be reaching out beyond their constituency, whereas if you're the Conservatives or the Republicans, you know, you're just going to get sneered at for the people you're apparently in bed with, you know, helping them. So it was the Clinton administration that was trying to seem economically liberal and fueled the Clinton boom. And what was done was that we removed this distinction between banking and investment and said, let's get rid of Glass-Steagall in 1999. Banks can do anything. And that's part of the problem, some would say, of the crisis now, is that we mixed taking core deposits from ordinary people, dealing with ordinary people in the one institution, and then speculating on the markets wildly at the same time. And clearly, you know, losses in one can then start to affect the other. Northern Rock's the classic example of what had historically been a very conservative, with a little c, building society, that took deposits from ordinary customers, and that was the money it used to lend out to people by way of mortgages. Very conservative model. Very unlikely a firm like Northern Rock was ever going to go bust, because it didn't have a huge amount of debt, it didn't borrow huge amounts of money, it didn't speculate on investment markets. But then it decided to change its model, get involved in the US subprime debacle, and all the whizzy investment products that were built on top of that. Derivatives we'll talk about in later lectures. And it changed its business model wildly and stopped being a nice conservative, just lending out the money it's received in type of bank. And that's where it all went wrong. If you were being mean, you would say, just people at Northern Rock that had never done this kind of business before and just didn't know how to manage it. And then it all went horribly wrong. First run on a UK bank for centuries. So this is thought to be one of the great concerns, you know, mixing these kind of things into what's happened in the world is that we have gone from a universe in which there were huge numbers of banks, yeah, retail and investment. And now we have comparatively few, because there have been so many mergers over the years. Mergers of really enormous institutions. Citibank, that was huge anyway, probably the biggest bank by volume in the world, merge with Travellers Group, which is also enormous, which had just bought up Salomon Brothers, one of the old investment managers. You looked at the recent crash, you know, we've got Merrill Lynch being bought up by Bank of America, all these banks consolidating. So if you're studying competition law, you've suddenly got a problem there of worrying, is there sufficient competition in the market? Can this ever be an efficient market? Now we have these huge monopolistic providers. You know, as there are ever fewer of them, and as banks always in their markets often trade as herds, and they all start doing the same product and all start chasing the same investments and all think the same thing about whether a share is valuable or not valuable or whatever it may be, then actually we're just creating greater risk for the future. Even if you are a free marketeer, you've got to start being concerned about, is there any real competition here anymore? There are so few banks left, so few independents, and they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger as they merge. So we'll talk about this, you know, more as we go on in later lectures, but there's a huge consolidation of banks, so that's another great problem, which is why it's important as we talk about the law never to forget the context of what's going on in the background, because amongst the lawyers, the regulatory specialists, the discussion tends to be quite narrow, but it's important to keep looking at what's going on out there in the world. Important indeed. Okay.
So that's other big themes. So the bullet points there, investments and securities, trading versus banking, trading, investment banking versus retail banking versus commercial banking, trading and corporate finance, jolly good. Speculation, funding and risk management, we'll come back to later on. Oh, I've got Blaustieg on the handout, sorry, from the 1929 crash. Yes, what can we do? The ambit of the law of finance. I've mentioned a little bit about what's the role of the lawyer. I think the lawyer does three things. And the lawyer manages risks. Law itself is a risk. There's a risk that your transaction won't be enforced by a court. That in itself is a risk. There's a risk in a common law system that a judge may deliver a judgment that changes the law. And that's risky for financial markets, because you may have signed your contract in 1990, and then there's a judgment in 2000 that says, actually, the rule now is this. You know, the House of Lords deliver a new judgment, and it all changes. There's always that risk when you sign a contract. What if the law changes underneath us? Because that can happen in a fairly invisible way. I mean, unless you really are a specialist and you're reading the cases closely, as you know from your studies so far, it's not always immediately evident that there's been a huge change in the law. It can take 10 or 20 years for there to be a drift. And everyone thinks, actually, this is different now. We're not doing that the same way. That in itself is a risk. Given that most of this law is built on English law and New York law, you know, out there in the world, that's what the markets are doing. Common law systems, the law can change underneath you. There's not always a well-publicised bit of legislation, so we all get to read about it in advance. And that's part of your role, then, as specialist, is to carry this knowledge around and understand what those risks are. You're helping banks to manage their risks. Risk management is really big in financial institutions. You have these mathematicians, with literally PhDs in rocket science, a lot of them, you know, calculating risks, looking at historic market trends, calculating how markets have behaved in relation to specific, you know, economic data and whatever else, again, which we'll talk about as we keep going through the course. They are managing risk in that sense all the time, but I think lawyers are doing the same thing. You're assessing risks,
putting contracts together, thinking, well, if this trade is going to last for 10 or 20 years, I've got to try and anticipate what could go wrong in that time, and how do we get our clients out of the problem. So at that level, you're risk managing. I think that's the best way of thinking about what a lawyer does. You're also a translator, as I mentioned before, translating, communicating between finance and law.
Two different systems there, different ways of thinking, different norms, different languages.
You know how much you like, you lot all like numbers, whenever the numbers are put in front of you. Structuring products. Structuring, I think, is a really useful word. One of the things that a lawyer can do, rather than just being a miserabilist and just saying this is a risk, this is a danger, there's a very positive thing you can do as a lawyer. This is what I did a lot of at Goldman Sachs. I remember shocking a lot of traders saying, we can just do it this way. I mean, you should use a trust. Nice and simple. This is the benefits. We can do this. You know, a couple of biro strokes on a bit of paper. Really? You know, someone said, I didn't know lawyers would be helpful. You know, there's a lot you can do as a lawyer just by helping to structure things, by making things better. So a lot of the things we're going to talk about through this year are things that lawyers can do, bringing concepts you know to play to help create new products or make new products work in a different way. So law has that positive role as well, as structuring. So you're creating structures. Contracts are structures. When you put them together, you are building a way in which two parties are going to interact. You put a trust in there as well, that's another structure. How do we hold the property there? So all of those things you can think of as being about building. Have we seen The Matrix, the film The Matrix? Yeah? There's that bit where, in the first film, where Neo, Keanu Reeves' character, is dead, or whatever the hell's happening. And obviously, the woman kisses him, because this is the great Hollywood thing, isn't it? You know, the person you love kisses you, and suddenly it's all right, yeah? He comes back to life, then he realises he can go and fight the baddies in their sunglasses and their black and white suits. There's that moment when he comes back to life, when the baddies are at the other end of the corridor, there's three of them looking down the corridor at him, and they fire their guns, and you see all these bullets come at him. And the bullets just stop in midair, because he's Keanu Reeves and he can stop bullets in midair, and they just twirl slowly, and then he picks one of them out and just drops it, and the others just fall, and the baddies go, oh my god, he's all powerful after all. There's a sequence where he suddenly sees the world. He sees the Matrix. He sees it all in terms of what's obviously supposed to be computer code or whatever the hell it is. These are the three baddies at the end. Yes. You as a lawyer are basically seeing the financial world through your own matrix of law. You will see all of this as contracts, as torts, just as Keanu Reeves' character Neo sees the whole of the world suddenly in terms of computer code. And if you remember, it all spirals, it's all constantly spiralling down as though it's, you know, computer programs running. He suddenly sees all of that in a different way. Instead of it being human beings or looking like human beings at the far end, you will start to see everything in terms of contracts, potential torts, potential frauds, yeah, property rights or purely personal rights, guarantees, capitalization. You're going to see all these things through a lawyer's lens. Financiers will see them all through numbers, potential profits, you know, mathematical quantifications of risk. Everyone's seeing their own matrix through their own lenses. So that's what we're doing. We are really, you know, we've become Keanu Reeves at this moment. We are seeing it all through this particular eye and this particular lens. So we're looking at a world and bringing it through, which is kind of what Richard Nobles will be talking about in Jurisprudence. We start talking about this, you know, how do lawyers look at the world? How do we look at all this philosophy? How does it come through this lens? And how do those lenses work? So there's that moment, The Matrix. Brilliant, obviously, fun. Where does the word finance come from? What is it we're talking about? The word finance comes originally from the Latin finis, meaning an end, which leads to the French fin, meaning end, of course. The original sense, you know, what's end got to do with anything, is of settling a debt, ending a debt. That was its original medieval meaning. And that meaning developed over time into particularly paying off a ransom. Instead of just ending a debt, it was also paying off a ransom. I rather like that metaphor. Anyone who's got a mortgage will feel that some kind of sword of Damocles over their head as you're desperately trying to pay this thing off over 25 years, and suddenly, apparently, you're released and free. This is what finance meant. Then the French began to relate to the fineness of gold, because money used to be in the form of coins that were made out of precious metal. And so the value of your coins, you know, meant you literally had more money. and we'll talk about that in later lectures as well, how money moves from being literally handing around gold and silver. That's why in all those old movies you always see someone bump the coin. They're trying to test if actually gold or is actually silver, because that's what the coins were made of. Nowadays they're all made of base metal, yeah? They're all made of cupronickel alloys and all kinds of things. It's not real anymore. Our money is now just a myth. We just rely on the fact this bit of paper that we're given means money. We rely on the fact that a computer record equates to money. Waitrose believe you have money when you hand over this bit of paper or you shove a plastic card in and type in a four-digit number. They believe you have money. Yeah? It's all a huge con trick at one level. It's all about getting us to accept that these things that have no intrinsic value are actually worth something. Yeah? It's a huge myth. And if you go back through the history of the kind of 17th and 18th century, particularly the early 18th century, when in France we have John Law trying to introduce to the French the idea that they should give up their attraction to gold coins and accept instead bits of paper from the king that said, this is worth a franc. Well, people looked. Can you imagine the first time you get these bits of paper, this is not a franc. A franc is something that, you know, is a franc's worth of gold. And slowly the French had to be weaned off the need for gold and the need for silver. And the same trick as well had to be done in England, had to be done around the world. Slowly we moved away to what's called fiat money, F-I-A-T. We have to believe that we don't need gold anymore. We can just let markets and prices set their own level. And this is where modern finance really began. Things can have their own market value instead of having any intrinsic value. So finance moved from being to do with the fineness of gold and paying ransoms by handing over an amount of gold or an amount of silver, into being providing people, I would suggest, with the wherewithal to act. Yes. It's a recognition that you have credit and you have an ability to do something. To buy a service, to acquire a chattel, whatever it may be. One of my favourite short stories, under heading 5.2, Talon Ukbar Orbis Tertius, from the collection Fictions by Borges, who's an Argentinian writer, published in 1946, has the following conceit. Let's suppose we get some experts together and they write an encyclopedia about a planet that doesn't exist. We just make up a world and we start to discuss its flora and fauna, its geology, the, you know, animals that inhabit it, its climate. And the conceit of the story is, so detailed was this encyclopedia, all the thought that went into exactly how this planet functioned, what was it made of, but the planet was called into existence. Simply by thinking of it, we created it. I think that's a wonderful metaphor for exactly how finance functions. We call it into existence simply by imagining it. All of this are ideas, the development of human ideas over time, and carrying with it a huge amount of risk. If we jump, please, to the bottom of page 12. Risk is central to finance. If you remember from Robin Irons Against Tan last year, Lord Nichols told us all investment involves risk, and he was right. All of finance is built on risk. Something called the risk-return equation, which must be the top of page 13, I would have thought. Something called the risk-return equation is central to finance, central to all investment. Banks expect that if they have to take a given level of risk, a high level of risk, they expect a high return. Something that is risky should generate a large amount of profit to make that risk worthwhile. And that's absolutely central to how banks function. And that's a key part as well then of the financial regulation we're going to talk about, the risk-return equation. So Glass-Steagall was about trying to separate off risky from less risky things. Second bullet point, top of page 13. A lot of risk management uses financial models to try and anticipate how this risk functions. And the key risk, dropping to 8.4, risk-return is 8.3. Dropping to 8.4, number one, systemic risk. Is the absolute key one. Now, everyone's always talked about systemic risk. Until 2007 through 2009, I think a lot of financiers didn't believe it would actually come to pass. Systemic risk is this. Systemic risk is a risk that the entire system, the entire financial system might collapse. And this is in the minds of regulators, particularly banking regulators, and also a lot of trade associations. In the lacunae, where there is no financial regulation, what often happens is that trade associations are created by the bankers to draft standard market contracts, which it's hoped, if everybody uses them, will control a lot of the risks. It's a kind of self-regulation. Systemic risk is huge in things like the derivatives markets in particular. Anything that's conducted over the counter, by which we mean not on an exchange. Okay? So over the counter or OTC transactions, contracts are just created bilaterally between banks in private. Yeah? No exchange, no regulator necessarily looking at them. Things like the derivatives markets, you will have Goldman Sachs deal with Morgan Stanley, for example. What those banks do is say, I now have a risk that Goldman Sachs may not pay up or may fail or whatever else, so I need to get protection against that. And what that means is, in the marketplace, people hedge, as it's known. Which means you go and buy another transaction somewhere else which you think will show a profit, even if your Goldman Sachs transaction shows a loss. So you have to calculate what you think that risk is. You have to calculate what kind of product would show a profit if this kind of product shows a loss. So if interest rates fall in one market, what will make a profit if interest rates fall? Bond markets, usually. And then that, suddenly, that hedging transaction itself creates an exposure. So that needs protection. That needs hedging against. In the meantime, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs will have done thousands of transactions between one another, all those traders. Morgan Stanley will have also have dealt with, I'm trying to think who else is left, Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank will have dealt with JP Morgan Chase. JP Morgan Chase will have dealt with Goldman Sachs thousands and thousands of times. So you end up with a web of millions of transactions coming into existence, expiring, some of them going on for a number of years, all at once, this web. And the great concern is, what if one of these big players went bankrupt? Would that cause a systemic collapse? What if one of those banks just fell out of the picture? This has always been what the trade associations were concerned about and drafting their stuff for. And I think most bankers just thought this is never going to happen. Lehman Brothers is exactly that happening. Collapses owing about $600 million, and it was entirely sure exactly how much. We're still trying to count it all up in amongst the dust and the debris and the screaming. Yeah. Largest corporate bankruptcy ever. Largest bankruptcy ever. And it showed exactly the kind of contagion that can spread. One huge player falls out, and then we have literally thousands of transactions. There were estimated to be $400 million worth of credit default swaps that Lehman Brothers left unpaid when it went bankrupt. And what happened, there was a huge auction in New York where everyone sold off their transactions with Lehman. And people bought them on the basis they thought, if I bought the other side of this, would I make a profit or not? And it took a number of days, just everyone locked in a big room in New York, trying to just auction this stuff off, to stop everyone saying, I haven't been paid, oh my God, and having to put a loss on their balance sheet. Better if you sold it for something. So this is going on in the world. So this systemic risk is the risk that all of that simply collapses. And it's that huge risk that we're going to be thinking about next time when we move on to think about financial regulation. If that's the risk, is the regulation getting anywhere near dealing with it? Okay, jolly good. That'll do for now, and we'll pick that up next time. And I'll try my best to get all this stuff up ready on Blackboard for whenever you're allowed to look at Blackboard. Good night. If you haven't got your handouts, they're all downstairs in reception.